This book that's being sold for $4.95 in the United States can be purchased for £1.50 in England. It's only 88 pages long, and wait a few months, and that'll be worth 75 cents. And so you can get it at a real bargain if you go there. The title for this lecture, like the one before, was selected not by me but by somebody else, and I decided to largely ignore it in planning my lecture. We might get the author to explain what it means. Actually, it's some difficulty in talking about bureaucracy these days because I want to talk about what I would call the new theory of bureaucracy, and I presume there are some people here who already know a great deal about it and some people who don't know anything at all about it. And so I decided, you have your choice. You leave half the audience not knowing what you're talking about if you give an advanced lecture, and you bore half the audience if you give a good introduction. I decided to go in for the latter, that is, an introduction, in the theory that the people who are being bored eminently deserve being bored. One of them was the author of this title that I'm just complaining about. So I'm going to talk about the new theory of bureaucracy and start at a fairly elementary level. There are traditionally lots of theories as to what the government administrative staff does. These tend to be, like most political, traditional political theories, deeply involved in moral principle. That is, it's assumed that the bureaucrat, like the politician, is going about the world seeking out the public interest and attempting to then maximize it. Two examples of theories of this sort are associated with Max Weber and President Wilson in the administrative area. The Weber theory, I think, is practically unknown today except to specialists, but maybe to members of this society it might be better known because it happens von Mises was Weber's student. And von Mises, therefore, accepts Weber's theory and then criticizes a bureaucracy of the type that Weber describes as not a good way of running a railroad in his work on bureaucracy. And I take it many people here know von Mises. As a matter of fact, as far as I can see, there never has been a bureaucracy that behaved the way Weber described bureaucracies as behaving. So saying that it's not a good way to run the railroad is true enough, but it doesn't have much effect. The other general theory of bureaucracy, and the one that has been dominant in the United States for a long time, is associated with the name of Woodrow Wilson, and interestingly enough, is almost 100 years old today. And this theory holds that the government is divided into two groups. There are the political leaders who make policy decisions, and then there are the professional bureaucrats who administer them. And the administrators are supposed to simply carry out efficiently, morally, etc., the policy decisions made by their superiors. This also is not what happens in bureaucracy, but it is, I think, the dominant theory if you read the literature today. Still, it's falling apart, I would say, but it still is the dominant theory. Well, the thing that's intriguing about both of these theories, in particular the Wilson one, is it assumes that the bureaucrats are not like the rest of us. Instead of attempting to maximize their own goals, they're attempting to maximize somebody else's goal, which is a sort of unusual thing for assuming human beings to do. We normally anticipate that most people are, to a considerable extent, interested in themselves. Now, not completely. Every walk of life has people who are charitable to some extent. In fact, I might even say that every single person, with the possible exception of Van den Haag, has at least some element of charity in his makeup. But we don't normally depend heavily on that in trying to get people to work. As Adam Smith put it, we do not depend on the goodwill of the baker for our bread, but on his concern for his self-interest. And similarly, in dealing with a bureaucracy or a court system, we should not be concerned, if we're trying to design a good one or if we're trying to describe an actual one, we should not assume that the people running it are simply trying to maximize somebody's best interest other than their own. There may indeed somewhere be a baker who is primarily engaged in charitable activity. I presume he would give away his bread if that were so. But we don't expect to find him very often. And we similarly should not expect to find a postal clerk who is primarily interested in efficient transmission of the mail. Now, the baker may indeed provide very good bread at a very low cost if the institutional structure is such that he will lose his business if he doesn't. The postal clerk also presumably would provide good postal service if that was the only way of keeping his job. As it happens at the moment, he can't be fired no matter what he does. And so studies with respect to mailmen indicate that they are putting in on the average in a four-hour day. Being a government employee myself, college professor, I should say that I think 4 hours would be a rather large estimate of the average time investment of college professors. But in any event, what we should assume is that mainly people in bureaucracy are doing things which are to their own interest. A well-designed bureaucracy is one in which the person pursuing his own interest will tend to do whatever it is he's supposed to do, and a badly designed bureaucracy is one in which socially undesirable behavior pays off. What we want is a bureaucracy such that, on the whole, people are led to do what they should do, and we have, on the whole, a fair number of very big examples of that floating around in our society. For example, General Motors. It's a bigger bureaucracy than most nation states. And although, heaven knows, if you look inside it, you find all sorts of things wrong with it. Niskanen, who's an expert in this area, says that sociologically, there's no difference between the General Motors and the Department of State. That is, you find rivalries and people concealing and so forth. But nevertheless, on the whole, it works fairly well. Produces good cars on the whole. It even is rather good at deceiving the government when it turns out to be profitable to do so. On the other hand, if you contrast it with the Department of State, the bureaucracy in which I first got my indoctrination in all of this, it's very hard to argue that it's accomplishing much of anything. It may be. I mean, it's hard to argue it isn't either. It's very hard to find any way of measuring whether it has an output. And therefore, for all I know, it may have the highest best cost-benefit ratio of any institution in our society, because since you can't find out what benefit is, at least that's a possibility. My guess is the cost-benefit ratio, if you put benefit underneath and put cost above, is one of those things which under the laws of mathematics we're not permitted to do. You know, you may not divide by zero. But I don't know. I can't say I know that for certain. Well, why do we have this difference? The simplest explanation is that the General Motors is trying to do something fairly simple. Make money. Furthermore, it's fairly easy to measure how accurately various subordinate divisions of General Motors make money. Now, I emphasize only fairly accurate. Anybody who knows anything about accounting realizes that there are serious gaps and defects in the accounting system, and you do not know exactly which of the two divisions is making a certain amount of money. In fact, you may not know whether you are making money, particularly in an inflationary period in which the values of all your assets are continuously changing. But nevertheless, compare that with the effort which faces trying to find out whether the Department of State is doing well. Consider, for example, let us suppose we were 5 years ago and we still had an embassy in Saigon. I believe that Texaco also had an agency in Saigon which was selling petroleum products. It was much easier for the general management of Texaco to find out whether or not that agency, which was selling petroleum products, was in fact making money on it, which is what they were supposed to do, than it was for the Department of State to determine whether our embassy was effectively doing whatever it was supposed to do. There are now rumors that one of the things it was doing was bugging the president of South Vietnam's cabinet room, which, by the way, I would regard as an evidence of efficiency if they were doing it. I'm not convinced they were. But in any event, it's not clear that the people who walk in Washington concerned would have regarded that as another example of efficiency. It's not clear what they were trying to do. We have no simple method of measuring output in most bureaucracies. Now, some cases we do. Some cases we can, in fact, measure the output. The post office is an example. We can find out how many letters are carried, no problem at all. It turns out, however, that in general, when you do get something can be measured from a government agency, they have a monopoly in the service, so you can't compare them with other people. And the post office, most of them argue they have to have a monopoly for one reason or another. Post office is a clear-cut case, but as far as we can tell, you find cases where there is competition between government agencies and private agencies. There aren't very many, but there are some. It happens, for example, the post office has literally been driven out of a number of areas where it doesn't have a legal monopoly by various private companies. It still has a legal monopoly in first-class mail, of course. But in any event, if you find the places where you can compare government service with private service, you normally find it costs the government about twice as much to do anything as it does the private areas. Furthermore, you normally anticipate that these areas where you can make this comparison are, and by the way, they aren't very many. They're special. The post office is one example. Fire protection is another. Rubbish removal is a third. Police activity, to some extent, can't be compared there. And we don't have one in the United States, but Australia has a regulated airline and a private enterprise airline running under almost identical conditions. The private enterprise airline's costs are about half those per passenger mile of the government. So this is a quite general rule, but one would anticipate that these would be the areas where the government would be most efficient, because they'd be subject, Congress could make these comparisons too. They'd be subject to some pressure for efficiency. But they clearly are not very efficient. Well, why not? Well, let me go in now, I have to have a blackboard, to two reasons. The first is, let us assume you're a bureaucrat and you are interested primarily in your own well-being, not entirely, of course. No one's ever entirely interested in their own well-being, but primarily so. Well, how do you increase your well-being in bureaucracy? Well, obviously, there are a number of things you can do, one of which is just not work very hard. We all rather like leisure. Once again, college professors seem to be major contributors on that line. Let us say, if he weren't in a public place, I mean, we could get him to agree too, but any event, take leisure is one thing you can do. You can improve the conditions of your office in various ways. I don't know whether you're familiar, the federal government has a regular schedule of the kind of furniture you can have, depending on your rank. I remember when I was in the Foreign Service, everything went wrong in Korea. I had a conference table in my office, although I didn't really rate one. What I rated was a rug, but the rugs were very rare in Korea, and so the people who normally would rate conference tables got rugs, and the people who would normally rate rugs got conference tables. We had more tables than we had rugs. But anyway, there's a regular set of rules of this kind of thing. You can see to it that the people you're dealing with are pleasant instead of hardworking. If you simply select the best man to do some job, he may turn out to be somebody you really don't like terribly much, and you can do it. But all of these things in our society, I think, are subordinate to one other, which is simply to increase the size of the bureaucracy that you're the head of, increase its budget. Now, I should emphasize that is simply true of our particular bureaucracy. It hasn't been true of all bureaucracies in history. It's not necessarily true of all bureaucracies in existence now. But for the last 100 years or so, most West European and American governments have followed policies such that expanding the size of the bureaucracy you're in general, benefits you. And that being so, there's a strong tendency to do it. If there are more colonels, if the army is bigger. And if you are already a West Point officer, you can get promoted. If the thing is bigger, you have more power in a given position. If it is expanding, in general, you have a greater ability to do whatever you want. Because under the civil service regulations, in general, you can't fire people. And therefore, your ability to control the action of people depends on either new hirings or promotions. And so expansion gives you some power of that effect. But although I think that expanding the bureaucracy is probably the largest single casual thing that a bureaucrat will do to get ahead, it has to be emphasized it's not entirely the only thing. There are other things that can be done. And also, a lot of bureaucrats are interested in the quiet life, nice offices, and so forth, and don't want to work hard. And in a way, they generate better benefit. Well, suppose that we temporarily accept completely this expansion of the bureaucracy as the goal of the bureaucrat. And let's take a perfectly ordinary economic diagram. Suppose we have some government service that can be produced at a constant cost. The constant cost would be down here, of course, would be used by a private company, but we ignore that.
I wonder whether we could speak into mic.
Try it. I thought this wasn't functioning.
It is now.
How does one get it out? Oh, here we are. Anyway, we have
tell us again what the...
This is an ordinary economics diagram. This is, as usual, a dollar value variable. And this is a quantity variable. We assume it's some government service. You can make up your own mind. The government service is going to be measured in value terms. That is, this just straight line indicates the cost of providing different amounts. I just finished saying that, of course, we've done privately, the cost would be down here. But as a matter of fact, that is, for this diagram, not true. And there's some demand for the government service of that nature. Now, the straight line demand is something we normally draw in economics because we're used to it. It doesn't seem to cause any great damage. But anyway, this, of course, as any economist will tell you, is the optimal quantity to be produced, and you produce it at that price if we were going to have an efficient agency. If we happen to have a private monopoly producing it, it would produce that quantity and get a monopoly profit like this, and it's less efficient than a competitive market because you lose this time. Well, what happens if a profit maximizer, if a bureaucrat is producing it? Well, suppose he produces this amount out here instead of the optimal amount. He'll be producing units out here that are worth less than their cost, less than the terms of whatever kind of evaluation. Is something wrong with this mic? I seem to be getting a return. He'll be producing more, these units down here are worth less than the cost, so this is inefficient. Well, why can he do this? Well, he does it by telling Congress that he has a peculiar cost function. Now, characteristically, he says that that his cost really looks sort of like that. He presents Congress, when it comes around to the budget negotiation process, with false information as to his cost. So Congress, obviously, he knows more about cost, his cost than Congress does. Furthermore, he knows in general what this demand curve is, because the demand curve for Congress for this particular good is a derived demand curve. It comes from their feelings what the voters want, and he, as a specialist in the area, can find out pretty much what the voters feel. Let us say he can find out what the agricultural part of the community thinks about the Department of Agriculture's output. So he can simply make false statements about his cost, and the Congress can't make false statements about their demand, and he can usually get away with it. Now, he can't always get away with it. And this can lead to an overproduction of the good in the sense of producing useless units. Now, if he carries this to the extreme, he produced something out here in such a way that the size of this triangle here is the same as the size there. He, in that case, has completely exploited his power over Congress. This is simply a theoretical proposition right now. I'm rather proud of it because it's not clear whether Ms. Cannon or I invented it, but one or the other of us did. And we got in print almost simultaneously in separate sources, and as a matter of fact, the whole thing came up in a series of bunch of conversations between the two of us, so who invented it isn't clear. But if we look at what actually happens in Congress or in the state legislatures, etc., we do observe this. Not only even there, I, for a while, was on the council of the American Political Science Association, and we were in financial troubles, as learned societies periodically are, and the secretary was asked whether there was anything he could do to save money. And he said, yes, as a matter of fact, he could. It would be possible to cut back on the three girls who were engaged in mailing the journal and answering inquiries from subscribers. Now, this, of course, was the one thing that he was doing that would cause great pain to the members of the society. Firing the, quote, policy officials, close quote, in the headquarters would not have been noticed by anybody. But it's the only economy that he suggested as a possible economy to the board. And I was the only person on the board who knew about this. So I think I was the only person who realized how perfectly he was carrying out his theoretical duties. One can find many other examples. One which I particularly liked happened about 15 years ago. There was a cut in the budget for the department, the Customs Service. And the civil servant in charge of the Customs Service responded to this by laying off every single customs inspector in the United States and not laying off one single office boy. Now, in this particular case, he'd gone a bit too far. Congress got annoyed, and he was transferred. But needless to say, he wasn't fired, nor was his salary reduced. But he did get transferred. And all of this is perfectly rational. If you can produce out to this level, if you can use a budget, which is maximized. You see, what you do, in essence, you transfer what we call a consumer surplus from the consumers to the production of unneeded services. And at the same time, you raise your own wage because you're now head of a bureau that's twice as big as it was before. And it's pure waste. The private monopoly isn't really pure waste. I mean, after all, a guy goes off and enjoys himself on the Riviera. And I may not like that, but at least it's not waste. In the case of the government monopoly, it is pure waste. Well, I'll put this back temporarily. This seems to fit a lot of the real world, and it's a very simple, straightforward theory, which comes out of simply assuming that the individual is trying to maximize his well-being, subject to a peculiar institutional structure, an institutional structure that works more badly than the institutional structure which we see in private market. I should say, just in passing, this is an intriguing fact, but if the guy is maximizing labor, we may do better. I mean, if he's maximizing leisure, we may do better. If he's lazy, he won't, not only will, in the first place, his cost line will be higher because he's not as efficient, but also he won't get fully informed on the size of all of these things. And so instead of absorbing all of this triangle, he'll absorb some smaller triangle, and so the society will be rather better off if he is lazy than if he works hard. Our success in government depends to a considerable extent on the fact that we don't have a lot of hardworking bureaucrats. This theory, to repeat, it's a little simple. Bureaucrats maximize other things than simple size, but it does seem to fit a large part of the world. In fact, the statistical tests, they're hard to do, but the ones that have done so far turn out pretty well. Well, there are some other problems, even if you get rid of this goal, which the people have for simple expansion. And one of them is an intrinsic characteristic of any large bureaucracy. And I began to turn the blackboard to erase this. What you're doing in a large bureaucracy in general is trying to control what people below you do. Now, mostly, what they do is not something that's totally under control. I mean, an infantry captain drilling a field, a unit on a drill field, can literally see what everybody is doing. And presumably, he gets, after they've been well drilled, complete obedience. When he says about face, they all about face. But most government activities, most hierarchy activities, the man at the top doesn't have perfect information of what the people below are doing. And as a consequence, he cannot guarantee that they will do exactly what he wants. Now, the Department of State, as I mentioned before, is an extreme case of this. It's very difficult indeed for the Secretary of State in Washington to know what it was that our ambassador said when he was talking to the Foreign Minister of South Africa, shall we say. There's nothing really in general to prevent the side of the ambassador who feels like it's simply lying. And they do. There's a famous case that Bismarck, who was started his career as ambassador in St. Petersburg, quarreling with the Russian foreign minister and said, and of course, he said, no, don't answer me like this. I know you're going to because we've broken your codes, and that's what they said in your telegram you're going to do. And then he paused and said, having committed one indiscretion, I'll have to commit another. Would you kindly continue using the code for unimportant matters for a month or so that my foreign minister won't find out? I don't know whether that story is true. It is widely reported. But in any event, you can't, in general, control your subordinate perfectly in any system. Now, once again, the accounting system in a government, in a business, makes it easier because of the fact it is not impossible to at least approximate how much money is being made. But it's very hard to tell in most cases where you're trying to do something like, let us say, prevent people from committing fraud in the securities market or influencing foreign policy what's being done. Let me assume, as a rule of thumb, that you can control your subordinate on the percent of 75%. That is, 75% of his efforts will be exactly what you want. Now, and the other 25% won't. Now, that number is not very vital. I'm going to use it to work out something on the board, but it's not very vital in any. You can substitute another number, and in general, granted the size of which we observe government bureaucracies to be, it doesn't make any difference. Well, suppose we have a bureau chief, and he has some subordinates. I'm only going to talk about two of them, probably two chains of command, rather. He has a subordinate And he can control that man's behavior to the extent of three quarters. That is one quarter of the activity of that man does are his own preference, three quarters out of Europe. Once again, the one makes 90% of the difference, except I would need a larger blackboard.
Which means a better joke than that, or more force.
Okay. Well, this man has a number of subordinates. We'll take only one again. And he can control each of those to the extent of three quarters. But the compound interest formula comes in. The man at the top, with respect to those, has only 9/16 of their time under his control. And there's another subordinate down below that, 27/64. And the next one is 81/256. And you can go on down. Now, as you observe, there's an interesting characteristic. The man at the top has almost no control over what is being done at the bottom. And on the other hand, the individuals have no personal freedom. It's the worst of all possible worlds. Everybody is subject to fairly severe personal controls in the sense that he's controlled 75% of his activity, and the organization itself is uncontrolled. I call this bureaucratic free enterprise. Let me put another man in just for a particular purpose. Assume there's another superior here, another subordinate controlled three quarters. Well, what is the likelihood that these two will be behaving in a coordinated way? Well, this is a sort of a complicated issue, particularly since there'll be more than two superiors. This man probably has 7 or 8 subordinates. But we can take the minimum, which in this case is 1/2. That is one, if the minimum likelihood that they will be doing the same, that they will be doing the same thing with respect to the same thing is 1/2. And down at this level, it becomes 1/8, and below that is 0. You don't get coordination from this system, and you don't get coordination, you don't get freedom, combination, which is very painful. I should say that all of this, as it happens, although it's only recently been applied to bureaucracy, is a fairly well-known ancient research result. Now, there's a game called Whispering Down the Lane. I don't know whether any of you have ever played it, in which things get distorted as they go through. The psychologists have also tested it rather extensively. And if you simply transmit orders, this kind of thing will happen. With a distortion figure, it's hard to get an exact measure of the size of the distortion, but the distortion is very large. If you truthfully transmit the order, I mean, if you give a man a piece of paper and tell him to pass that particular piece of paper on, there isn't much distortion. But even if you tell him to copy what's on the piece of paper, the distortion that develops is in a very remarkably few steps is quite high. Well, this being so, large organizations become more or less impossible if by large organization you mean something that is carrying out some big task. If by a large organization you just mean something that is standing there, of course that can be done. But it cannot carry out large tasks. And I think this is the basic reason that most American corporations are no longer operated as a large single, that is a big corporation, as a single large hierarchical organization. They used to be. It's only in the 1920s and 30s that they changed their modern form. But under modern circumstances, most large American corporations actually function as a holding company. That is, there will be a central organization and then a large number of what are usually called profit centers, which are usually, to all intents and purposes, an independent, separate company. And the central organization, partly because of the fact that it has the accounting system and partly because it's large enough to do a lot of independent investigation and auditing, can get some idea as to the efficiency with which the individual units are operating, but does not make any particular effort to directly control them. You have General Electric, for example, has two companies, two profit centers, which engage in the production of household electrical appliances and which are bitterly competitive with each other. Not only that, they go around making nasty cracks about how the other guy's products aren't any good. Or at least they, I've had them do that to me. but in any event, this, what I call bureaucratic free enterprise, is likely to develop in any large organization. It's one of the reasons why bureaucracy frequently appears to be sort of completely uncontrolled. It's very hard to get anything done. It isn't really that it's uncontrolled, it's that the control has this peculiar characteristic as you go from the top to the bottom. Now, of course, the fact you can't fire anybody in our particular civil service is also very important in that respect. But even in areas where you can fire people, this kind of thing may develop. Well, what can we do about all of this in the way of trying to get better functioning of the bureaucracy? The first thing that automatically occurs to almost anybody is that if you could improve the information that the people at the top have as the actual cost of generating the various government functions, you could that type of exploitation I showed on the first chart would not exist. Well, that unfortunately turns out to be very difficult. Not utterly impossible, but very difficult indeed. And I think most people concerned with the area have come to the conclusion that it's not a very valuable source of information, not a very valuable line of research anymore. Although Niskanen did point out that in general, cost-benefit analyses of that sort, if they don't do any good, in general don't do any harm either, because the bureaucracy would have found some other way of wasting the money if they had not wasted it on the cost-benefit analysis. The second thing one can do is simply contract out government activity. Now, anybody who's looked at the defense sector will quickly realize this is a long, long ways from a perfect solution. But I think there can be little doubt the defense sector, in fact, is more efficient than things like HEW. You do, in fact, in general, get good airplanes, even if they are pretty expensive. Secondly, it might be better possible to improve the contracting mechanism. I don't know. But neither of these, I think, are likely to be gold mines, even though I suspect large savings can be made from the second one. And by the way, almost anything can be contracted out. If you look around the world, you find that the government's decision as to what it should do and what it should buy seem to be random. One of the things that always impresses me is the fact that most governments buy their highways and then repair them themselves. That is, most highways are constructed by private engineering companies, but the maintenance is generally done by a government bureau. There doesn't seem to be any intrinsic reason why that combination should exist. And you can find almost anything you care to has at some time in the past, at any event, been done by private contract. Armies and navies were largely private contracts at one time. Elizabeth's Navy, that's Elizabeth I, was largely a private entrepreneur affair, somewhat corrupted by the fact that the Queen was one of the entrepreneurs. When there was a major military operation going on, they would set up a corporation to carry it out. Let's say they're going to raid Cadiz, or they're going to try and intercept the treasure fleet. They'd set up a corporation, and the Queen would get stock in the corporation in return for agreeing that they could use some of her battleships. She had the biggest ships in the country, you see, because she was the only person who had true battleships. She didn't keep them manned. She just let them have the battleship. The corporation had to hire the people who were going along to do the fighting. But she would loan the battleship out and get maybe a 25% stock interest in the Cadiz Raid Corporation as her return. And it turned out to be a sizable source of revenue to her over the years, because that was a very successful Navy. But in any event, armies, Louis XIV's army, for example, was almost entirely a contract business. That's, in fact, why we have the rank of lieutenant colonel. The colonel was a guy who was a businessman who raised a regiment. But since he was a businessman, he normally, A, didn't want to get shot at, B, had no feeling that he was particularly good at command anyway. And so he hired another man, a lieutenant colonel, who went out, got shot at, and commanded the regiment in combat. And we now have this title built permanently into our rank. A lot of other things can be done that way. For a number of years, the most dangerous activity engaged in by what we can loosely call the American Armed Forces was flying U-2s over Russia. And this was done by private contract employees of Lockheed Air Corps Corporation, who got paid rather more than Air Force pilots normally get paid. Although they were, generally speaking, Air Force pilots on temporary, who had been returned to the reserve for this job. We can go on and on with these contracts. Anyway, that's possible. Beyond that, there's another, which is simply decentralization. In general, if government services are purchased by a small government agency, firstly, there will be a number of different government agencies purchasing a service, and therefore you can compare the police budget in Blacksburg with the police budget in Christiansburg, these being two little towns which I'm familiar with, and also the performance. And I don't think one could argue that our city councils do a very good job of this, but at least they do have some information that would not be available. If you're trying to figure out how efficient the FBI is, you don't have any comparative data at all. They're just one of them. Is it or is it not spending far more money than is needed for whatever it output is? Now, in the case of Blacksburg, you can find out what the service in Christiansburg is costing and, roughly speaking, what the crime rate of the two places is, and so forth. Now, there's no reason to believe either of these police forces are particularly efficient, but presumably the existence of the possibility of comparison lowers the increases your efficiency here. Furthermore, the fact that the voters are voting in a small unit and hence have more influence may have some effect. And last but not least, the fact that voters don't have to vote, they can move. If Blacksburg chooses to have a tax rate which is higher compared to the services offering in Christiansburg, there's no reason you can't move to Christiansburg, which is 9 miles away on a divided center highway. One of my colleagues, in fact, is now living in Christiansburg, although he's teaching in Blacksburg because the rents are lower there. Most of us aren't doing this, but it's certainly possible, and so there are more pressures for efficiency. However, once again, I don't think this is a perfect solution. The final one is simply to reduce the total size of the government. If you grant that the government hierarchies are going to be rather inefficient, then the arguments for putting some service into government hands is weaker than it otherwise would be. It's a pure efficiency argument. It had nothing to do with anything outside of efficiency. But let us suppose that we are contemplating, getting rid of the post office, as we all are. One of the arguments for it is simply that it will cost less if the government is not doing it and someone else is, because of the inefficiencies that I have been describing. There are other areas where you just would decide maybe you wouldn't have any. Let us suppose we have some area where the market will work badly. We know this, we needn't discuss market failure here, but we know for certain the market will work badly in some area. It doesn't follow from that the government should be substituted for it if the government is also going to be worked badly. We may be just stuck with a situation in which there's no way of doing anything that doesn't work rather badly. Or it may be that bad though the market works, it will work much better than the government. That's frequently true. Many government agencies, I'm sure, could be replaced by the market, and many other government agencies doing nothing at all might be better than what we are doing. Because every time you add a government agency, you not only get an inefficient entity, but by increasing the size of this hierarchy down which orders are distorted, you lower the efficiency of the remaining government entities. Well, that finishes.